I'm going to just start by saying this is very much a presentation that was produced collectively, as our study was carried out collectively. So I do want to begin by acknowledging my two co-authors, Karen Stagnitti and Andrea Nolan, neither of whom were able to take this fabulous journey with me. So I'm presenting on behalf of the three of us. And the title for my talk, If Things Aren't Right for You, It's Okay for You to Walk Away, is taken from one of the parents we interviewed, and you'll hear about them later, who was describing one of the things she tried to teach her child in terms of how to respond when they met something difficult and upsetting. So it was one of the strategies that she had for supporting her child's resilience in early childhood. Okay, I have no relationships to disclose. To start the presentation properly then, I want to say a little bit about resilience. It's a complex and it's a very multifaceted concept that's been researched now for over four decades in a variety of disciplines, including medicine, psychology, education, the three disciplines we draw on, I suppose, particularly in this research. Now, while the earliest research on resilience tended to treat resilience or conceptualize it as a character trait, understood as some kind of innate toughness that you either had or you didn't have, a product of nature rather than nurture, contemporary research emphasizes instead that although there may be biologic and genetic components, resilience is more appropriately thought of as a human capacity that can be developed and strengthened in all people of all ages. And resilient children, I'm going to be talking about today, our working definition there is that those are children who thrive and develop despite facing challenging circumstances. Now, that's a definition that draws on the American Psychological Association's definition of resilience. So a significant feature of this notion of resilience that we're exploring is that it's dynamic and contingent. From the literature, the research literature that already exists, what do we know about supporting resilience in early childhood? Well, there's many different ways of cutting through this literature. I'm just going to give you the one that we decided to use really as our framework for analysis. So we can talk about four different things as being very important, and the fifth one is something slightly different. First of all, positive and supportive caregiver relationships are enormously important. Those can be the parents, but they can be other adults as well. The psychosocial environment is important. Promoting social-emotional learning is important. And self-regulation, which some people like to put under social and emotional learning, we've identified separately because it's particularly important. In the work that we were doing, we were really concerned to look at how the use of community resources influenced all those different strategies and ways of supporting resilience. So I've put that on the slide as well. So the Supporting Resilience Study. Our study aim was to investigate the phenomenon of resilience in depth within the context of significant periods of transition for children and young people who live in disadvantaged areas. I'm going to be talking just about a small part of the study today. I'm going to focus on the early childhood cohort. This is a small, in-depth study where we followed 26 children for 3 years from their preschool, kindergarten environment through into the first 2 years of primary school. And we actually collected an awful lot of data, including very quantitative assessments of the children. I'm not going to be presenting that data today. Instead, today, the analysis I present draws on the interviews we carried out with parents at 2 points, at entry into the study, and in the final year we were following the children, and the interviews we carried out with the teachers of each child. So that's different teachers in each year of school. I want to acknowledge funding. This is an Australian Research Council funded linkage project with three industry partners: the Department of Early Education and Early Childhood Development in Victoria, VicHealth, who are the statewide health promotion agency, and Community Connections, who are a statewide NGO. So, I'm going to pause there, and before you, I encourage you to look at that slide, say that what I'm going to do is walk through those different strategies for supporting resilience that we found in the literature, not in the same order that I put them on that slide, and compare and contrast what we learned about the parents' strategies and what the teachers told us about their strategies. So, first of all, self-regulation. Now, self-regulation refers to the child's ability to manage skills, emotions, and behaviours to actively participate within their environment. Here, mothers, and I should have mentioned, we asked to interview parents. In fact, it was the mothers who volunteered for each of our children. But they did talk about what the fathers did as well. So mothers often talked about self-regulation in terms of independence. And one of the most frequent strategies they talked about in terms of how they supported their child's self-regulation was building specific routines within the home, where the child had their own clearly understood responsibilities, such as tidying their bedroom, remembering their lunchbox, or assisting with carrying out some kind of task within the family. These help children to develop their organisational skills and become independent. And quotes from the two mothers in green, a metropolitan mother and a regional mother, illustrate the way they talked about this. On the right-hand side, we have two examples of the strategies teachers used. And certainly, teachers also talked about promoting independence in the classroom. They talked about all the ways each child had their specific place in the classroom routine. But they also talked about some other things as well. The first rural preschool teacher talks about what she drew from the ideas outlined in the ALERT program, Williams and Schallenberger, which is designed to assist children in developing strategies to recognise their states of alertness, hyperactive and agitated versus calm, and to do something about that if they find themselves in a hyperactive or agitated state. So, in describing the use of this program, the first quote from this teacher: so just releasing your energy so you might push on the wall or take deep breaths. We do a lot of deep breathing and calm down. We have a calm area that children can go to, so it has fiddle toys and you just have a fidget, so calming yourself down that way. And this teacher talked about how the children were encouraged to learn to take themselves to the calm area, and if they didn't get there by themselves, the teacher would encourage them on their way. The second example from a teacher, this is the year one teacher, so that's the second year in the primary school, illustrates the way that teachers talked about encouraging their students to reflect on their past actions and choices and use that as a basis to think and plan for next time. Teachers at all levels, from the kinder through to year one, talked about the importance of this type of approach, carefully describing how they encourage students to learn from mistakes, but carefully avoiding labelling past choices as bad or wrong. They always talked about what would have happened if you made a different choice. So, the quote there, encouraging children to focus on what can you do next time? Then we do lots of that reflective stuff to them as well. The what can you do? Oh, maybe this. That would be a good idea to try next time. And then if they're in that situation, oh, remember what happened last time. Oh, what are we going to do this time? So it was constantly encouraging the child to develop reflection on what had happened and whether it would have been a good idea to try and make something different happen. Next, moving on to promoting social and emotional learning. Here, this was discussed extensively by both the mothers and the teachers. And here, mothers particularly focused on supporting their child in developing skills related to forming and maintaining positive peer relationships, as well as responding to challenges or hurtful or harmful behaviour from their peers. Very important strategies they discussed were spending time in the family talking, analysing what had happened or choices that had been made, and practising with their child how to respond to the particular social situations they might encounter, such as building friendships, or what do you do if someone steals or takes away what you're playing with. In this way, families sought to support their child in building their problem-solving skills, particularly in relation to developing positive peer relationships. And I've just put up quotes from two of the mothers there, illustrating the way they thought about that. Teachers actually drew on the same repertoire of strategies. Teachers also spoke about the importance of them as teachers being positive role models. In particular, recognising that we all learn from mistakes, making mistakes in front of the children, and highlighting that making mistakes is okay. It's not bad or wrong. So, a rural preschool teacher said, "I think that that really helps. A positive outlook, positive role modelling, positive attitude, positive language, and you can try. You can do it. Keep trying." A metropolitan grade one teacher shared a practice which a lot of the teachers developed, circle time. So in the classroom we have circle time where we talk about different strategies and role play, how we can just deal with situations. Circle time allows for discussions so that students know the rules and can feel comfortable amongst talking amongst their peers. Such practice in circle time gave the students the actual words they could use in a future challenging situation. When something had happened in the playground or in the class, circle time was used for the group collectively to reflect on that and to talk about what could have happened differently. Okay. Supportive relationships with adults. This was something that came out very strongly from both the mothers, talking about the parents' strategies, and from the teachers, again, at all levels. Mothers talked at some considerable lengths about the benefits of the relationships children had developed with other adults, that's adults other than the parents themselves, especially preschool teachers, and members of their own extended family, as well as adults in the wider community. Some mothers saw this as a specific role for preschools or kindergartens in helping children gain the skills to form and maintain relationships with adults. Many mothers here also discussed their use of community resources of various kinds as offering good opportunities for the child to develop such relationships. All of the mothers faced multiple challenges in their lives. I haven't presented those in any detail, but each family was struggling with one, well, two or more adverse child events, if you like. Some mothers reflected specifically on the importance of building a network of other adults for their child to draw on when they were not able to be there in the way they wanted to be. So they saw the value of those other adult relationships in scaffolding their child's resilience. Teachers at all levels discussed the importance of a consistent, supportive relationship, and the quotes illustrate, and they emphasised the importance of their role in building connections with their students. Families and teachers working together. Actually, we didn't find a lot of discussion of the way that families and teachers could explicitly work together. And one of the take-home messages for us from this is that there's a lot of scope for encouraging more of that. Oh, so on the mother's side, examples focused around responding to problems or challenges And the quote I put here, which I'll let you read for yourself, illustrates how multiple means of communication could be brought to bear. In particular, the mothers used the diary, which is a way that they could alert the teachers for something that had gone on, and the teacher could write a comment back. They didn't need to find time together, which is often difficult to do. They had various means of doing that. Building a network of other adults for their child to draw on when they were... Teachers also talked about the newsletters their schools produced. Newsletters that contained helpful tips and strategies which they wanted to share with parents for their use. Interestingly enough, none of the mothers reflected on any of those strategies. They talked about the newsletters only in terms of advertising events. So there's a little bit of work that needs to go on there in terms of getting those used properly. Okay. Summing up. All mothers and teachers talked easily about a variety of strategies, and that was very important. There wasn't a single mother in our study for whom the notion of doing things explicitly to support her child's development and her child's ability to bounce back, as most of the mothers talked about resilience, they all did things very deliberately. Strategies they discussed were used by fathers and the family as a whole, and those were discussed by some but not all mothers. A lot of the mothers were in single parent families. The strategies that both the mothers and the teachers identified covered the full range of facilitating factors for supporting resilience we could identify from the research literature. And I haven't really had a chance to go into this in too much detail today, but families and schools' use of strategies was very constrained by the environment and availability of resources, so that actually the group in the regional location that we looked at had far less available to them. I think the major take-home message for us was that there was a lot of further scope for active collaboration between parents and schools. What I found quite tragic in some of the interviews with teachers was that they weren't aware of the very active strategies the parents of their children were using. And actually, a little bit more awareness of how much the mothers and families were already doing would enable a far more active collaboration to take place. So that when we've presented, as we have done, on the parents' strategies back to educators, there's been this kind of, wow, light bulb moment. We can work with that. We should do more with that. At that point, I will say thank you. Any questions?
I think that's a really interesting idea that the teachers aren't aware of the parent strategies, and I'm wondering in terms of the demographics of the teachers versus the parents, how many of the teachers, because this is early childhood, they tend to be younger, are actually parents.
Okay.
So make that bridge be possible.
Yeah. A lot of our early childhood teachers actually in this study were not young women. It was actually they were all women, but the very wide age range. And in the metropolitan area, they weren't necessarily resident in the same area as the mothers and the families. In the other areas, they very much were part of the same communities. I think the teachers often focused on the difficulties in the families, and as I've said, all of the families were facing challenges. Insecure income, insecure housing, family violence, illness, it varied. They tended to focus on the challenge and not actually and focus on the problem solving around those day-to-day challenges, rather than having the time to appreciate, perhaps, that there was an awful lot going on in the periods perhaps where the family wasn't quite in crisis mode. And so I think it was really useful for them to learn that as something they could build on. So I guess it's that lack of time to sit down and have that conversation, that detailed conversation around the child where there isn't a problem. Any other questions? No? Okay, thank you.